there are idyllic public schools somewhere in the urban core of every city in America. These schools are nearly ideal, with students coming from mixed racial and socioeconomic backgrounds. These schools have high graduation rates and high test scores. To be sure, there are such schools. But according to today's guests, they're very, very hard to find. I'm Jabalani LaFall, and on today's Central Standard, Michael Petrilli, an education policy expert and author of the book, The Diverse Schools Dilemma, talks about the larger issues of educational inequality and his own struggles as a middle-class parent in finding a school within the city limits that has the right mix of cultural diversity and achievement. We'll explore those conditions and ask what you think. That's on Central Standard after this hour's NPR News. City. There are many misconceptions about the landmark Brown versus Board of Education in Topeka, Kansas Supreme Court decision. Many believe it was the first such case in the country. It was actually the 11th case in the country and the third in Topeka alone. But the most common misnomer in that case was that it made segregated schools unconstitutional and created a lasting inequality in education. This is Central Standard. I'm Jabalani LaFall. Today we examine diversity in education, the unintended consequences of school desegregation, and the policy changes and balancing cultural awareness with educational achievement, plus the inherent policy challenges this presents. And joining us now for this very full discussion today is Michael Petrilli, Vice President of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, a K-12 education policy think tank. Mr. Petrilli is also the author of The Diverse Schools Dilemma. Also joining us is Dr. Lawson Bush, professor and a director of the Cal State LA and UC Irvine Joint Program in Urban Educational Leadership. And we'll be joined later in the hour by Mr. Spark Bookhart, who graduated from an African-centered education program in LA and is working on a book called The 40-Year Collapse. So let's begin with Michael Petrilli. The subtitle to your book is The Diverse Schools Dilemma, A Parent's Guide to Socioeconomically Mixed Public Schools. Why is finding a school such a dilemma?
Well, first of all, thanks for having me on, Jabalani, and for helping me get the word out about the book. The dilemma is this. There's a lot of parents today, middle-class, upper-middle-class parents of all races, who like the idea of sending their kids to socioeconomically mixed public schools, schools that serve both affluent kids as well as low-income kids. The question and the dilemma is whether those schools can serve all of those different kinds of kids effectively. And in the book, I get into the pros and cons of those kinds of schools, both for poor kids and also for affluent kids. And what I find and what I argue is that it is a dilemma. There are trade-offs, and it is hard for schools to serve both low-income kids and affluent kids well at the same time. It's not impossible, but it's hard. And I try to arm parents with information they need so they can go in and take a look at schools and ask the right questions.
Talk about your background in St. Louis. You said in your early childhood, your only exposure to black people, for instance, was through Bill Cosby and Michael Jackson. Tell us about growing up in this environment and how it informed your process later in life.
Sure. I mean, I grew up in West County, outside of St. Louis, Chesterfield, in the Parkway School District. And before fifth grade, there were virtually no African-American kids in our school. And, you know, so like I said, I didn't have much exposure to African-American culture or to African-American people. Then in fifth grade, the desegregation program started that's now quite famous. And actually, St. Louis's deseg program became the largest program in the country. African-American kids from St. Louis started coming to our school. By the time we were in probably middle school, it was up to about 20% of our school were kids from the city. And so I do reflect on that in the book. About that experience, that and in many ways it was a very positive experience, though, as I think is the case in a lot of these desegregation programs, there wasn't a lot of mixing between the two groups of kids, especially in classrooms where most of the honors classes were still the white students from the suburbs, and most of the remedial courses were the African American kids. At the time, that was largely because those African American kids were coming from schools that were so subpar, they were just so far behind. I would hope that after all these years that there is more integration going on in those schools.
You also bring up then-Governor John Ashcroft and his very virulent opposing of the DSEG program. He later became U.S. Attorney General, of course, but was governor of Missouri back then. And so that was a very contentious issue.
Yeah. Now, of course, I didn't know that at the time. I mean, I was a kid, you know, who didn't really understand the larger politics at play. But when I went back to look at this issue now, all grown up, talked to people about the history of that program and was reminded about just, you know, the racial politics that were in play. I mean, that he used that issue quite effectively in his campaigns for governor, that there was a lot of antipathy from the white suburban areas towards that desegregation program, and he was certainly able to use that to his advantage. It seems like over time there's been more acceptance of that that approach, although in St. Louis now that the program is, I understand, winding down.
And you bring it forward in your book to sort of balance out your personal anecdotes on the issue to bring the larger issue to fray. And bringing it forward, you talk about the difficulty of finding a diverse school in your current home of Washington, D.C., in the district. Talk about that.
Right. So I'm probably one of these classic Gen X creative class professionals, you know, white upper middle class interested in moving into the city. This is, of course, a new trend, kind of the gentrification generation.
Do you have a bicycle?
I have a bicycle. I ride my bike to work. I do. And absolutely, I fit the stereotype perfectly. And more and more sort of middle class, upper middle class parents are willing and interested in living in the city. You know, this isn't happening everywhere, but in cities like D.C., parts of Brooklyn, parts of Denver, you know, parts of L.A., San Francisco, there's really a noticeable trend in shifts in demographics. And, of course, the big question remaining is, you know, will those families stay once their kids reach school age? Will they be able to make the public schools work for them? And that's what this book is about, that when you're in a neighborhood where the schools are diverse, not just, you know, racially, but more importantly, along class lines, can those schools work for all of the kids?
And therein lies the dilemma and thus the premise of your book.
That's right.
We're going to bring in Dr. Lawson Bush. He is a professor and director at the Cal State LA and UC Irvine Joint Program for Urban Educational Leadership. Dr. Lawson Bush, what are your thoughts on the legacy of Brown versus Board of Education and how it's affected cultural diversity in education? And we'll let Mr. Petrelli expound on that as well, but welcome you to the show as well.
Good morning, and thank you for having me on the show. What we often don't discuss in terms of what happened is the number of black people that were opposed to desegregation. Literally in North Carolina, you had black people who fought with guns to defend their schools. We don't talk about the number of black teachers. They estimate about 80,000 black teachers lost their jobs. Thousands of principals lost their jobs. Then we saw the systematic closing of what we would call at that time black schools or segregated schools. And this has left a devastating and lasting impact on communities. Schools were the bedrock of communities. And so these schools were systematically closed throughout the South. And so later, around the 70s and 60s, 70s and 80s, when it got time for these parents to send their children to school, they were looking for diverse schools, but no one ever asked the question, are these schools good for black children? The assumption was that they were because they were desegregated, but now we're beginning to find out that they're not.
Michael Petrelli, you have anecdotes in your book that pretty much speak to that effect. And you also said there's a downside to diversity in schools. Talk about that.
No, absolutely. And, you know, people go back and you can read some of things that Martin Luther King Jr. said and wrote about. And he was nervous about integration. He said, look, you know, we've got this group of people, a lot of whites, who think that our race is inferior. And now we're going to let them teach our kids. You know, there was a lot of nervousness about that. And what you see in many schools, you know, we see, of course, a huge achievement gap still between the performance of the average African-American kids and average white kids. And what you see in some places where that gap is closing are schools that are not actually integrated, but schools that serve entirely African-American or minority populations that are closing the gap and getting great results and using approaches that might be fairly traditional, fairly strict, disciplined, that many African-American educators have argued for a long time is what works well in the African-American community. But methods that many white parents, upper middle class white parents especially, don't want for their own kids. And yep. So the question is, if you bring kids together, you know, whose needs get served? If there really are different approaches that may work best for different groups of kids, it's a tough one.
You're listening to Central Standard on 89.3 KCUR. Streaming live on KCUR.org, I'm Jabalani LaFall. Today we examine a very contentious issue, diversity in education and the unintended consequences of school desegregation and the policy challenges it thus presents. We're talking about balancing cultural awareness with educational achievement. Our guests are Michael Petrelli, Vice President of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, a K-12 educational policy think tank. Mr. Petrelli is also the author of The Diverse Schools Dilemma. And also joining us from the Los Angeles area is Dr. Lawson Bush, a professor and director at the Cal State LA and UC Irvine Joint Program for Urban Educational Leadership. Kansas City, how important is an education in a socioeconomically and culturally diverse environment for you and your family? Do you feel the push for diversity in schools is actually a harm to children? What are your feelings on desegregation of schools and the environment it has created in its wake? 816-235-2888. That's 816-235-2888. Or you can send in an email at centralstandard@kcur.org. We're also available on Twitter, where our handle is @KCURCST. Dr. Lawson Bush, tell us about your work with the Urban Educational Leadership Program, and what are you seeing as the biggest challenges from a policy standpoint?
Well, the biggest challenge in general is just really how we're defining education. And this is really the basis, not in terms of we can decide whether or not diversity is working, whether the African-centered education is working. Tangent is really on this question of how do we define success. So we define success as test scores being raised, an achievement gap being closed according to the data. And then one might say the schools are successful or unsuccessful. But if we define success as being able to go back to your community and serve and help them to thrive and these types of things, then we might design schools different kind of ways. So to me, the largest issue what I push with my students in the program and really as a policy is keep trying to push what do we mean by successful or successful schools.
You're also very familiar with the concept of African-centered education or ACE education, a very contentious issue here in Kansas City. Tell us, for our audience members that don't know, what it is and how it benefits not only black children, but society at large.
Well, very in short, I mean, we need a long program to really tease out what it is. But in short, it's the interpretation of reality or from an African-centered perspective. It puts from the curriculum that enables students to see themselves and their ancestors as the leading contributors to human history and culture. That really is it in a quick nutshell. But it is both a pedagogy in terms of how you teach, but it also is also what is taught in the curriculum as well.
We're going to bring in Spark Bookhart. He's a local management consultant and working on a book about KC's school district since the Brown versus Board education decision called the 40-year collapse. Spark Bookhart, welcome to Central Standard.
Thanks for having me, Jabalani.
Talk about the 40-year collapse after Brown versus Board and your experience at Marcus Garvey School in L.A. and ACE program.
Absolutely. Well, I think the 40-year collapse, what I'm calling it, is delving into the process of just this, the understanding that this attempt at forced integration, and that being the panacea for all the problems that ail black education, I think that has proven to be a failure. And that's the premise of my book. And we look at Kansas City. We look at Kansas City schools, particularly as a case for that. As far as Marcus Garvey, my alma mater, which is an African-centered private school in Los Angeles, I think the very extreme value of African-centered education is an education that's centered in your own culture. And I think that This is something that everyone does anyway, whether it's Saturday schools or religious schools or Montessori-type programs. Everyone seeks to find value in their own culture, and I think that you become a better participant in the world when you have a knowledge and appreciation of your culture. The more knowledge and appreciation someone has of your culture, the more value they have for your very humanity. But the more ignorance and disappreciation they have for your culture, your humanity is even suspect.
Let's bring back in Michael Petrelli, the author of The Diverse Schools Dilemma. Mr. Petrelli, your book mentions the concept of desegregated schools with segregated skill tracks, or students separated based on skill level, even once they're integrated into a school. Talk about that concept.
Sure. So imagine you've got a school where you've got, on the one hand, upper middle class kids, maybe predominantly white, and then you've also got low income kids, perhaps predominantly minority. In general, those schools are going to have a huge gap in achievement and a huge spread. You're going to have some kids who are reading and doing math way above grade level, other kids who are going to come into the school probably way below grade level. And the question is, if you're a school, how do you handle that? Well, one option is to group the kids by their current achievement level. But if you do that in these diverse schools, what you will generally be doing, not entirely, but generally, is you'll be grouping kids by class, if not by race. And so then you've got schools that are, in fact, quite segregated on the inside, even if on paper they look like they are diverse. And so this is part of the dilemma. And I think everybody would agree that that's not an outcome that we want to have. But then you say to a teacher, OK, so we don't want to group kids by ability. We're going to teach them all in the same classroom. Well, now you're a first grade teacher with kids who, you know, are separated by five or six different grade levels. So how do you handle that? It's very, very difficult. So this is another challenge. And this is, I think, the key challenge that diverse schools have to figure out, is how do they manage this diversity. In the book, I look at how some schools handle it, you know, the pros and cons. I think that probably the best compromise is to do some grouping some of the day, maybe in reading and math, and then make sure that the rest of the day that the kids are all mixed together so you can get the benefits of diversity. But even that is an uneasy compromise.
We're going to bring in Dr. Lawson Bush. What do you think about that, this concept of desegregated schools with segregated skill tracks that we were just talking about with Mr. Petrelli?
I absolutely have researched that, and you really find what they just call school within schools. You'll find where there are students, a group of students would never interact with other groups of students. So they have almost a separate building, a separate lunch. They engage in separate activities. They go on separate field trips. So they really have a dramatically different schooling experience than the other students. Yet the school might be 30% black, 30% Chicano, Latino, and 30% white on paper, yet there's a vastly different schooling experience for the students in that particular school.
And
that's
happening
across the country.
And there's a voluntary social segregation as well, Dr. Bush, sometimes.
It's voluntary, but it's also really structured.
So if you wanted
to engage with another student, it would be almost impossible just by the structure of the school day.
Mr. Petrelli, do you agree? Is it structured that way, and does the voluntary social segregation exacerbate that?
Right. Yeah, especially middle school and high schools where you've got kids, you know, taking different class periods, that if you do have some subjects tracked, then it tends to mean that all the subjects are tracked. And one of the schools I looked at that was an elementary school, they were trying very hard to make sure that the kids weren't grouped the entire day. But because the kids were grouped for part of the day, the kids still ended up spending time. You know, that those are the kids they got to be closest with, and so you still saw a lot of self-segregation at lunch and at the recess and that sort of thing.
The question of the day was, Kansas City, how important is an education in a socioeconomically and culturally diverse environment? How important is that for your family? 816-235-2888. That's 816-235-2888. You can also hit us up via email at centralstandard@kcur.org or Twitter, where our handle is @kcurcst. Let's go to Jeff in Rock Hill Gardens. Jeff, welcome to Central Standard.
Thank you. My comment is slightly off topic, but I'd be interested if any of your guests would want to criticize it or comment on it. I've always had the feeling, even though I'm not involved in education, haven't been in school for 40 plus years, that the most important factor in the success of kids is their parents. There's no influence that's greater and can the parents watching over the children every day and making it clear to the kids that education and doing well is as important as any other factor in their life, I think that is what makes a huge difference between different communities and different socioeconomic levels. And I don't have any answer for how you get parents who are completely disinvolved and whose households may be in an uproar to buy into this idea. But when you look at the Jewish immigration early on, you look at the cultural backgrounds of people from China and Korea and many other places, where education is absolutely critical to the parents, I think that's where you see success.
Thank you, Jeff. We're going to let everybody respond to this, but we're going to start by talking to our in-studio guest, Spark Bookhart. Your daughter, Camille, just graduated from an African-centered program in education at KCMO last year, and you've been very involved in your daughter's educational process. Talk about the parents, because Mr. Petrelli talks about that in his book, too. We'll go to him next.
That's right, and that's a good and in fact, that is on topic, caller. You can't talk about education of children without talking about their parents' engagement in their education. And parent engagement and parent involvement is a critical tenet of African-centered education. It was a critical tenet for my parents and my African-centered education, and it was a critical tenet in ACE and my daughter's educational sojourn. So it's so important as a process that we require it. African-centered education, true African-centered practitioners require parent engagement, building off of the African proverb, it takes a village to raise a child.
On the other side of that, Michael Petrelli, he's the vice president of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, a K-12 education policy think tank, and the author of The Diverse Schools Dilemma. You present the case of being a father. That's one of your biggest motivations in this book. Talk about the parenting, Mr. Petrelli.
Yeah, absolutely. And Jeff is right. I mean, there has been evidence forever, but certainly hard social science evidence for 40 years at least, that the number one factor influencing kids' achievement is what's going on at home. You can see a direct correlation between certainly things like poverty and achievement, but also family structure. You know, that as we've had in this country a sharp decline in the number of two-parent families, that shows up in student achievement or the lack thereof. And the issue is we don't have great solutions for that in terms of public policy. How do we rekindle marriage? How do we strengthen families? That's a hard issue. So a lot of the efforts has been at saying, well, if we can't do much about what's happening in the family, then we got to make schools as effective as possible. And I think that's what's giving the school reform movement such energy. But it's an imperfect solution, and it, you know, it only meets part of the problem. I think in these diverse schools, you know, if you have kids coming in, some from sort of intact families, two-parent families, others, you know, with just single moms who are struggling to, you know, put food on the table, working lots of jobs, you know, you have to find ways to navigate that. In some of the schools that I looked at, for example, you see, you know, how do you make sure that the single moms feel like they can participate in the PTA events? Or if there's fundraisers at the school, how do you make sure that they don't feel exclusive to the lower income families who might not be able to afford to participate? These are the kinds of issues. It takes especially a strong principal, very strong leader, to be able to navigate these sort of class and racial lines and, you know, make everybody feel like they're a part of the community. Again, very, very hard to do.
Let's bring in Dr. Lawson Bush. You're the third father of the bunch and also very intimate with these urban educational leadership conundrums.
Yeah.
Talk about that.
I'd like to address the caller's question. There's an underlying assumption in his question that suggests that certain groups value education more than others. And far as, you know, African peoples are concerned, from the beginning of time, really, up to the 1960s, we can make the argument that no one valued education more than African peoples. We literally built temples and monuments that took hundreds of years to make to demonstrate how much we love education. And even once we got here in terms of our enslavement, we risked our lives to build educational institutions. When it was we can be killed to read, we found black people on the corners reading pieces of books literally on the corner, just with candles, reading pieces of books. Then we built schools. We had fundraisers. If they didn't have a way to school, we created buses from tractors. This happened all the way up into the 1960s, and so something happened as the one of the as we suggested in the 1960s. So we absolutely love education. Now, we might hate schooling, the process that trains us to be like somebody else, but we love education. Yes, parents are a huge factor in education, but perhaps even equal or tantamount to that are the teachers. We find in some areas that have the same socioeconomic backgrounds where we see some schools are successful and we see some schools that are not successful. Same group of parents, same group of challenges, so you have to suggest that something about that school is making a difference.
We're going to go to Miriam in Overland Park. Miriam, welcome to Central Standard.
Thank you, and I just want to say that I really enjoy your show, and you have the greatest name in the whole world.
Thank you.
but anyway, we used to live in Brookside, and we loved it. We had a gay couple across the street, an African-American family behind us, a Hispanic couple next to us, and we really, really, really wanted to send our kids to a school that would reflect that. Unfortunately, with the Kansas City school system, it was accredited one year, not accredited the next, just barely accredited the year after, and we had to make the really, really hard decision to move to a place where there was some consistency in the performance of the schools, and it broke my heart to have to, you know, move out here to suburban Kansas City. I love our neighborhood. I love our friends in the neighborhood, but there's really not a whole lot of cultural diversity in the school system, and that really is disappointing. And I can take my comments off the air. Thank you.
That seems to be the story. We're going to take a quick break. More when we return about the educational policy initiatives that our guests say may solve the conundrum of balancing cultural diversity and achievement. Our guests are Michael Petrelli. He's the vice president of the Fordham Institute, a K-12 education policy think tank. He's also the author of The Diverse Schools Dilemma. Also joining us is Dr. Lawson Bush, a professor and director of the Joint Program for Urban Educational Leadership at Cal State LA and UC Irvine. And we got Spark Bookhart here in the studio, who's authoring a forthcoming book called The 40-Year Collapse, about the legacy of the KC school system after Brown versus Board. Kansas City, how important is it to have an education that's socioeconomically and culturally diverse for your family? 816-235-2888. That's 816-235-2888. Or call in to email at centralstandard@kcur.org or via Twitter, where our handle is @KCURCST. And welcome back to Central Standard. I'm Jabalani LaFall. Today, we continue to examine the diversity in education, the unintended consequences of school desegregation, and the policy challenges that inherently come about when you're examining this issue with educational achievement and cultural awareness and creating that balance. Our guests are Michael Petrelli, vice president of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, a K-12 education policy think tank. Mr. Petrelli is also the author of The Diverse Schools Dilemma. We're also joined by Dr. Lawson Bush, who's a professor and director of the Joint Program for Urban Educational Leadership at Cal State LA and UC Irvine. And we're also joined in the studio by a local management consultant, Spark Bookhart, who's working on a book near to his heart about the 40-year collapse. That's the working title of that book. And it's about the legacy of Kansas City's education post Brown versus Board. Kansas City, how important is an education in a socioeconomically and culturally diverse environment for you and your family? 816-235-2888. That's 816-235-2888. We'll begin this segment with Dr. Lawson Bush. Is the biggest problem with educational achievement gaps based on race or class now? Because an often not discussed topic is also the issue of black flight out of the inner city. Talk about that.
Yeah, I mean, certainly socioeconomics is a factor. There's no denying that.
Yet clearly, study after study that, you know, attempts to look at this, race is the biggest factor, race and racism. And across the board, when you look within groups, when you compare blacks to whites or other groups, you find that no matter really how you slice it, that the question or the issue of race still tends to dominate the direction of what we find in terms of the achievement gap.
Mr. Petrelli, you argue in your book, though, that the concerns and approaches of upper middle class whites are the same concerns and approaches based on research of upper middle class blacks. Talk about that.
Right. And I think the dilemma, you know, is even bigger for upper middle class African Americans. You know, there's all this research that shows that many middle class, upper middle class African American kids, especially boys and males, underperform. And a lot of question about why that is. Is it the pressure to underperform? Is there a social cost to doing well? And many of those kinds of pressures go away, for example, in private schools. You know, so you see in the D.C. area, especially where I live and where there's a large upper middle class African-American community, a lot of interest in private schools among that community, because in those schools there is a different culture, and some of those pressures to underperform are not there. So I think that, you know, certainly race is still a huge factor, but I think the class factor is big as well. And absolutely, you see black flight away from some of these communities and into schools where there's a sense that that perhaps the standards are higher, and that there's not that the expectations are that you can be popular and achieve at high levels at the same time.
Let me give you a quick example of that. We find black students whose parents make over $100,000 a year. And we can say that's a decent amount of money. Score the same on SAT scores with their counterpart white students whose parents make below the poverty line $20,000. To me, that's a phenomenal statistic. To me, that would suggest that race is a huge or a bigger factor than class.
Definitely. Talk about Spark Bookhart, the peer pressure to underperform, the whole issue of acting white. If you achieve, if you learn, if you're smart, acting white. I think that's what you're getting at, Mr. Petrelli. You mentioned that in your book.
Right.
Is that correct?
Yeah,
yes.
That's right.
Bring Spark in to talk about that.
I think Dr. Lawson Bush, earlier comments speaks to this. Basically, what is the purpose of education? We have to look at that. And what happens is, if we're looking at education outside of its purpose, or don't see education as connected to solving our community's problems, what happens is you have this mass underperformance. I think that's what's going on. I think, as African-centered education purports, is that it understands that the purpose of education is to solve our community's problems. And when you're engaged in that process, I think you have much more engagement into the process of education, rather than education in the abstract.
We're going to go to the phones in a minute, but let's talk quickly about the concept of teaching students to learn how to learn versus teaching to the test. How does that play into this discussion, Dr. Lawson Bush? And then we'll go to Mr. Petrelli.
Well, since Bush, No Child Left Behind, we have really abandoned what I would call teaching for the most part. We have just focused on doing whatever it takes, and I can't blame teachers if your job is dependent on it, or they're publishing the scores in the paper. It makes it very hard not to teach to the test, but we find this massive effort really just to teach what's going to be on the test. And so that's to the abandonment of important things like critical thinking. Now, going back to quickly our other conversation now within the schools in terms of the higher segregated programs within schools, they're still teaching critical thinking, how to question, how to think, how to analyze. But it's the masses of the people that are getting really just how to bubble in a test. And we also are finding a lot of cheating going on in addition to just teaching to the test.
Mr. Petrelli, you wrote a primer, actually, on No Child Left Behind. Mm-hmm. So talk about teaching to the test and its detriments.
Sure. I mean, I think it is a problem, and it's certainly one of the unintended consequences of this law, is all this focus on getting kids over what's a fairly low bar on these basic skills tests. Now, my own view is the way that you fix that is by moving to higher standards and to much better tests, that we still need the information those tests provide so we can pinpoint how kids are doing and also the schools that need the most help or need some pretty radical overhauls. And Missouri, along with most other states, is moving in that direction. There's new Common Core standards in reading and math that are coming online and new assessments within a couple of years that are supposed to be a lot better and pitched at a much higher level so that if you're teaching to the test, you'll be teaching to something worth teaching to, that these are going to be higher level standards. At the same time, look, we can't get around the basic challenge here, which is that many low-income students are not anywhere near where they need to be in terms of even their basic skills. And absolutely, we want them to think critically, but we need them to think critically about something, and they need to be able to read and do math and learn important content to get there. And so, we've got to help move kids much more quickly to the basics and then further beyond the basics. But we can't skip that middle step.
I'm going to go to Gene and hold on just a second, Dr. Bush. We're going to go to Gene and Shawnee and hold your thought for just a minute. Gene and Shawnee, welcome to Central Standard.
Thank you very much. I've been listening to the program, and I think both gentlemen's points are well taken, and they're just right on. I'm a parent of three kids in the Shawnee Mission School District, and what I've seen over the time, I have a range of 8 years between the oldest and the youngest. So one child in college that was through school before No Child Left Behind, and the changes have been dramatic. Just totally dramatic, and I feel like the whole idea, it used to be there was a resource center, and the kids that had difficulty learning, they had some kind of reading disability or learning disability, they were served, maybe not the best, but they were served in a small ratio of teacher to student, and now all of those kids, all as many as possible, are all mainstreamed in one classroom, and the goal is to get everybody to pass the test, which is passing is a very low level, and the emphasis is totally on the middle child, the average child. And so those at the low level that have struggles, which perhaps they have a problem learning to read, maybe it isn't an intellectual problem, it's a visual problem. Those kids, they don't get a good they don't get an education because they need help one on one. They need somebody to diagnose why they're having trouble and to help them. And the kids at the upper level, the kids that can already pass the test, are learning nothing new. They're just sitting in the classroom, and so we need a way to teach all the kids so they all learn every day. And I don't know the answer, but I know that what we have now is not doing that.
We're going to go to Dr. Lawson Bush in just a minute. Meanwhile, Rebecca has emailed us at centralstandard@kcur.org saying, "We all recognize that schools reflect the larger social problems of poverty, racism, and a society segregated along economic and racial lines. But I don't think," she says, "that schools' problems can be solved without a serious effort to address the larger social issues that created them." And Rebecca brings up a very interesting point as we go back to Dr. Lawson Bush. Dr. Lawson Bush, give us the thoughts you were holding and tell us, does teaching to the test put minority and immigrant children at a disadvantage, as has been espoused by many critics of the current system?
I mean, as the first caller said quite well, again, the test scores are going up, but when we measure whether or not students know how to read any better or know how to do math any better, or doing better on other tests like the SAT, or they have better grades, or they're doing better in college, we don't find really any evidence that students are any smarter or doing any better when we measure that. So really, teaching to the test, as she said, is really just hurting everybody. Yet we need some way to measure, so I can't deny that. But it's really what we have now is really hurting everybody.
Let's go to Kathy in KC Mo. Kathy,
hi,
welcome to Central
today?
Standard.
Thank you for taking my call. My concern is I live in Kansas City, Missouri. I moved here back from New York a little over 20 years ago. I was very excited for my child to go to the Kansas City, Missouri schools, and I was faced like so many people, and I, you know, I'm white, I'm middle class, with schools that were unaccredited, schools that were not in my community, and I thought, I can't do this, and I ended up paying a lot of money for my kid to go to private school. I stayed. I didn't flee to Johnson County, but I only have one child, so I managed to do it with my husband. And I love my neighborhood. I love my community. I can tell you that I have a school that's two blocks from me, Hale Cook, that has been sitting there empty now for 3 years. I don't understand why, if we had a failed program from 40 years ago, it was the best of intentions. It was great on paper. It was a wonderful idea. But it doesn't work, and I think we all know that, and I so appreciate what so many of your guests are saying. But I think what's really important is to get back to community schools right down the street. If I'm a parent, I don't care if I'm a single parent. I don't care if I'm a married parent. If my child goes to school right down the street, that's my community. That's where I live. That's where I breathe. We have to get back to community schools and build from that point. That's how I feel. I'll take my comments off the air. And by the way, my sister-in-law is here with me, and she's an educator, and she agrees.
Thank you
so much.
Thank you very much, Kathy. Michael Petrelli, Kathy's story is essentially your story, right? One of the questions that you propose in your book is, how do middle-class or upper-class children fare in urban environments? That's one of the central questions of your book, and obviously on the minds of many parents. Talk about that, and we'll come back to our in-studio guest, Spark Bookhart, after that.
Right. And the question is, can upper middle class parents find schools that are both diverse and also meet some of their other interests and needs? The big issues, as I mentioned before, is academic diversity. How do we make sure that all kids get challenged? And, you know, upper middle class kids on average are going to come in doing pretty well and maybe above grade level. Do they get the challenge they need to keep moving forward? The other issue is educationally. A lot of upper middle class parents, especially white parents, want something that's fairly, quote, progressive, you know, something that's maybe a Montessori program or a Waldorf program are some of the names they go by, or something that's a very project-based, a lot of creativity, expression. Now, again, you find this across different racial and class lines, but in general, a lot of upper middle class parents wanting that kind of model, that tends to be very hard to find for all the reasons we're talking about in many of these urban diverse environments. And so, you know, parents have to set priorities. And what you see and what some studies have shown is that many white parents will say they value diversity, but they end up valuing some of these other things more. And that leads them to either choose private schools or to move to the suburbs instead of choosing the schools in their own neighborhoods.
You're listening to Central Standard on 89.3 FM KCUR, streaming live on KCUR.org. I'm Jabalani LaFall. Today we're examining diversity in education, the unintended consequences of school desegregation, and the policy challenges that are presented in balancing cultural awareness with educational achievement. Our guests are Michael Petrelli, whose voice you just heard, Vice President of the Thomas Fordham Institute, a K-12 education policy think tank. Mr. Petrelli is also the author of the book, Diverse Schools Dilemma. Also joining us is Dr. Lawson Bush. He's a professor and director of the Program in Urban Educational Leadership. It's a joint program at Cal State LA and UC Irvine. And our in-studio guest, who we're about to hear from in just a moment, is Spark Bookhart, who's writing The 40-Year Collapse, about the legacy of Brown versus Board as it relates to Kansas City. Spark, you had some thoughts to expound upon.
Yeah, I was thinking about how the conversation is around education is really focused on content. And that's a challenge. I mean, content is important, but what's missing out of that equation is the intent. And education has both components, content and intent. And when we focus exclusively on content and don't understand the importance of what we want out of education, the intent of education, I think what we do is we lose the value, and we run around thinking about programs or programmatic themes, but not what the intention of the education is for. And we have to get back to what do we want out of education.
Dr. Lawson Bush, what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I just want to go back. I think Mr. Petrelli is raising an important issue. It really is about how are we defining diversity. And do we simply mean that we just want different races to be in the building? And a lot of people say they want diversity, but when you begin to talk about diversity in terms of diversity of power, diversity in terms of social justice, then we find that most people don't really want diversity. So if you go to the school and now the dominant language is going to be Spanish, and you are made to feel uncomfortable, then you really didn't want diversity. You just want people, different races together, but you want the white mainstream to be the hegemony or the lead cultural content in that school. So it really boils down, as I think all of us are saying, is really how you define terms: education, schooling, success, and diversity. Becomes very critical to this conversation.
Mr. Petrelli, this is perhaps the most interesting point of this discussion, because indeed everybody is forced to learn about George Washington, but it's not a requirement to learn about Booker T. Washington, or better yet, anybody outside of the mainstream. And you mentioned that even with including a passage in your book that talks about parents wanting diversity, but not wanting the quote-unquote contamination of diversity. Talk about that.
Right. That came from a study from a Harvard student where she interviewed some parents in Seattle where they had a choice program, and parents could choose, you know, to put down on a piece of paper which schools they wanted, so she could actually look not just what parents say they want, but what choices they're actually making. And what you hear the parents saying is, yeah, I want diversity, especially racial diversity. They weren't so interested necessarily in socioeconomic diversity. In other words, you know, they would be happy to send their kids to school with upper middle class African American kids, but they weren't psyched to send their kids to school with low income African American kids. And I wondered if that was focused on white parents. I wonder how much that would be the case for upper middle class African American parents as well. I would take some exception to your quote about Booker T. Washington. I mean, I think there has been a lot of progress in state standards and curriculum and making sure that. That the history that kids learn is a history of all of America. I think we've made great strides on that front. Sometimes it's a little bit caricatured. I mean, it's the same African American leaders that are taught over and over again.
Every year.
I'm sure we could do that better. But I don't think we're at a, you know, and I think parents of all races and cultures get that we got to, you know, we live in a multicultural society. We want to do that. Again, though, the question is, how, you know, if you tell upper middle class parents, okay, you're going to get a diverse school, but, you know, your kids may not be challenged, or you may not get the art and music you were hoping for, you may not get the progressive approach, you know, many of those parents are going to say, forget it. And so we have to deal with these trade-offs and these priorities. And it's why I think we're going to continue to struggle to create integrated schools, even as some of our neighborhoods and cities become more integrated themselves.
William in KCK, welcome to Central Standard.
Hello.
Hello.
Hello. I was listening, and I grew up in Kansas City, Kansas, and I went to a predominantly black school. It was slightly diverse. And growing up, I noticed that probably the most racist people I knew were the black people that I knew. And it got me to thinking about our curriculum. And, you know, you had one guest there that was talking about intent. And it appeared that Eurocentric type of curriculum that we were being taught gave us a lack of appreciation for ourselves and the other minority groups around us. And as a result, we tended to take on the same racist attitudes as the people who were being taught that very same curriculum, you know, back in the 40s and the 50s. We started using the N-word, and we started having violence against minorities, which was ourselves. And I was just kind of wondering how, you know, if that issue is even being thought of in that way. You know what I'm trying to say?
I do.
And so I was just kind of wondering if maybe racism is being taught inadvertently by having a Eurocentric curriculum, and that it doesn't matter who you plug into that curriculum, you're going to have the same results, which is a high appreciation for whites and a very low appreciation for all the minority groups. And as a result, you know, you're going to have a premium put on white life and white lifestyle, and, you know, and it'll contribute to the violence that's associated within the black and minorities communities against one another.
Okay, William, thank you very much for your conversation and contribution to it. We're going to let Dr. Lawson Bush address that.
Yeah, first of all, I mean, there's a misconception. I mean, I guess there's some things that are introverted by education, but really everything is very much planned. Even how you get a single pencil into a classroom is a plan.
And so what is taught in school, why it's taught in school, is on purpose, for a reason. And the gentleman, you know, pointed out something that's, again, very, very, very critical in terms of the question of desegregation. You know, prior to that, we had, I wouldn't call the curriculum African-centered in terms of focusing so much on the history of Africa, but it was African-centered in so many ways in terms of the values. So the values that black children got from their black teachers, who also lived in their communities, also were their Sunday school teachers, taught them something that controlled their behavior or informed their behavior. Then once the schools were desegregated, it was completely lost. So this is what the gentleman is talking about. Then we, even though we had a black school, were really taught to be white and to hate ourselves, which is what we're seeing today.
And therein lies the dilemma, Michael Petrelli. I'm going to let you close out and solve this problem in 15 seconds.
Right. Solve this problem. We've only been trying to solve this for 50 or 60 years.
Right.
I think what we have to do is, first of all, be humble and admit that these are difficult challenges. And second of all, I think parental choice has to be a piece of this. In other words, we should allow there to be a diversity of schools, some that are integrated and where people come together and try to make diverse schools work, others that might be Afrocentric. And we tried that model. And so I think that we can't have a one-size-fits-all approach.
We're definitely going to revisit this issue here on Central Standard. We've been talking about diversity in education and the unintended consequences of school desegregation. Our guests have been Michael Petrelli, a vice president of the Thomas Fordham Institute and author of the book Diverse Schools Dilemma. We also had Dr. Lawson Bush, a professor and director of the Cal State LA and UC Irvine Program in Urban Educational Leadership. And an in-studio guest was Spark Bookhart, a management consultant who's working on a book about the legacy of Brown versus Board in Kansas City 40 years later. Thank you all for joining us.
Thank you,
Jabaloni.
And tune in tomorrow for The Food Critics. Our show is produced by Danny Alexander with help from Matthew Long Middleton. Kim Noble is our announcer. Emily Mutard manages our website. Central Standard's intro theme music is by Miles Bonney, and the outro is by The Wilnots. Up to Date is next. I'm Jabaloni LaFall. This is Central Standard. Enjoy your day.